afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. We have a weighty topic for you today, yet again. Merry Christmas, almost.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We always wind up talking about serious things. I had someone email me and say it was too depressing. Like, we try to have fun while we're doing it so that it's not too depressing.
We try to cover the whole story.
At the very least, we have experts. Hooray. So you're not listening to us go on and on about...
Us professional talking heads.
Yeah, right. Keep our day jobs. Okay. So today, as I'm sure those of you who listened last week will remember, we had Claire Lopez on. And the last 15, 20 minutes, we got talking about the EMP Commission. That really, I don't know, I'm assuming most people didn't know anything about, and we found out it had been disbanded, and then we ran out of time.
Yeah.
So.
And that's really a important thing, I think.
Yeah.
We need to know more about that.
So Dr. Peter Vincent Pry served on the EMP Commission. He was the executive director for the commission, and he is, I'll just give you his bio, and then you'll have to read the rest. It's very long.
And, for those who don't know, EMP means?
Oh, electromagnetic pulse. Well, he's going to tell us all about that. Okay. That's the, I was an English major. I was not a science major. so I'm going to stop there.
Well, I was an acronym major.
I know it makes the computers and everything go crazy, and I was having a little problem on that today. I can't scroll my screen. All I can see is this bio, thank goodness, the one page it got stuck on. So Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum, both Congressional Advisory Boards. He served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House and Armed Services Committee, and the CIA, just to throw in for good measure. He has authored Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, and Electric Armageddon. That's kind of got all the scary words in that title. And both are available from createspace.com and amazon.com. We have the links right there on the page. Our page is wethepeopleradio.us.
Along with other really good reads down there at the bottom.
Yeah, we've got both his articles, the one on Korea that I can't see the title of because my screen won't scroll. And I'm sure we'll get to all of that because we have him for the full show today. And I'm sure we'll run out of time.
As usual.
So the one thing I forgot to do, I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
So there, you can identify the voices. And Dr. Peter Pry is with us. So where would you like to start?
Well, perhaps we could start by defining what an electromagnetic pulse is for those in the audience who may not know about it.
For all the rest of the non-science people.
Yeah. An electromagnetic pulse, one should know about this because it actually constitutes the greatest threat to the United States and really to the existence of Western civilization. You know, both because it's such an overwhelming threat, and at the same time, because even though, despite the best efforts of the EMP Commission for 17 years to educate the general public and policymakers, it is still little known and little understood. In effect, to understand an EMP, going to Physics 101, an electromagnetic pulse is caused by a magnetic field set in motion. Magnetic field in motion will cause an EMP. And in effect, one way of thinking about an EMP is, you know, imagine a super energetic radio wave that's got so much energy in it that while it will pass harmlessly through people's bodies, it will destroy all the electronics with which it comes into contact with. So airplanes flying through the sky would have electronics in them destroyed, and the plane might crash. Automobiles might stop running because the electronics of the automobile engine will fail. The electric power grid, you know, would be destroyed. And we're not talking about a temporary blackout. We're talking about a protracted blackout from which the power grid, frankly, might never recover because, the commission on which I served estimated that if we had a nationwide blackout that lasted 1 year, up to 90% of our population would die. Starvation, disease, societal collapse. So there'd be no coming back from that. And that's because we're an electronic civilization. We depend upon electricity and electronics to support not just our modern economy, but support our very lives. you know, immediately. There's no pure running water without electricity. You know, food, even the supplying food, depends directly or indirectly upon electricity. All the necessities of life. Now, since we've got 2 hours, let me take the rare opportunity I have here to get into a little more depth to explain what an EMP is. And you can stop me if this is getting too pedantic and boring, okay?
Oh, yeah, if we've heard it already, you mean?
Well, if just kidding. People aren't interested in hearing it. If you understand how a lawnmower works, you know, you don't need a degree in physics to understand EMP, all right? In effect, when you start your lawnmower, you pull on a cord and you spin a cluster of magnets called a magneto, and that causes a magnetic field to move. And this moving magnetic field stimulates the movement of electrons in a coil that surrounds the magneto, and it actually creates a small electromagnetic pulse in the heart of your lawnmower that you can see in the form of a spark that sparks your spark plug. Now, the Earth is a giant magnet, and it's surrounded by a magnetic field that we call the magnetosphere. And if the Sun hurls a solar flare, technically it's called a coronal mass ejection, traveling millions of miles of Earth, a great blob of the Sun gets hurled out of itself, out of the sunspots, comes at the Earth traveling a million miles an hour or more, it encounters the magnetosphere, which over the millennia, over billions of years, has saved all life on Earth. Because if we weren't surrounded by a magnetic field, this ionized mass of plasma would destroy all life on Earth. But it doesn't. But what it does do, because the magnetosphere holds it off, so the coronal mass ejection flows around the magnetosphere and out into space harmlessly as far as life is concerned. But in the process of saving us, the magnetosphere gets deformed, it distorted, it wobbles around. And this will cause geomagnetic storms, a form of natural EMP, which will destroy electronics on Earth. And magnetic storms happen exactly this way all the time. Every year there are magnetic storms that happen, call them geomagnetic storms. But they're usually isolated to countries at high northern latitudes, you know, Canada, Finland, Sweden, Russia. Every now and again, we have experienced in our own lifetimes a significant one. It was called the 1989 Hydro-Quebec storm, and it blacked out half of Canada in 90 seconds. But it didn't, it only lasted a day. It only killed a few people and, caused, you know, maybe $1 billion worth of damage. It wasn't a civilization-ending experience because it wasn't the thing we're most afraid of in terms of natural EMP, which is the rare, once every century or so, geomagnetic superstorm, like the 1859 Carrington event, which is the most powerful geomagnetic storm known to us on record. But we've only been keeping records since 1859, you know. And man hasn't been an electronic civilization until later, the last two-thirds of the 20th century.
Was there any negative effect from that 1859 event?
It was. There was. Because electronics was just in their infancy, and telegraph systems were deployed all over the world. Wherever the colonial powers built a railroad, and they had built railroads in Africa, India, and China, and all the major continents, they would string a telegraph system alongside it. And the telegraph systems all over the world failed. We had just laid the transatlantic cable in 1859, connecting the United States to Europe. And the pulse from the Carrington event was so powerful, it reached miles deep into the Atlantic Ocean, burned out the cable, and it had to be replaced.
Wow.
Fires broke out in telegraph stations. If you have ever seen a telegraph key, I've got one sitting on my desk. Those telegraph keys in 1859, you know, they're not microchips. You know, they're big, bulky, heavy pieces of metal. And telegraph keys melted cables. The telegraph cables burst into flame and caused forest fires all over the world. The pulse was so powerful, it caused an extraordinarily bright. You would know if it was a geomagnetic superstorm versus a run-of-the-mill geomagnetic storm because of the brightness of the aurora borealis. The aurora borealis, and because it would be seen almost everywhere in the world. you know, the aurora borealis is usually confined to high northern latitudes, but in 1859 it was seen everywhere, including on the equator over the Hawaiian Islands, and it was so bright that you could read newspapers at night by the light of the aurora borealis in London.
Wow.
So you'll know if we get hit, you know, because of that extraordinarily bright and everywhere present aurora borealis. And that's what we're concerned about. One of the threats from EMP that we're concerned about is the natural EMP threat that could affect global civilization. And we're overdue for another Carrington event. You know, we estimate they happen every century or so. We're about 50 years overdue. I mean, you know, 1859 is more than 100 years ago. So we're more than 50 years overdue. We were narrowly missed a few years ago. I think it was in 2012 that we were missed by 3 days. An aurora borealis, a coronal mass ejection, a Carrington class coronal mass ejection crossed the path of the Earth and missed us by just 3 days. And had it hit us, it would basically have threatened billions of lives. It would have collapsed electric grids and electronic systems all over the world and put billions of lives at risk all over the world. NASA estimates the likelihood of the recurrence of a Carrington-class geomagnetic superstorm is 12% per decade, which virtually guarantees that within our lifetimes or that of our grandchildren, you know, we will experience this. And it's going to happen 100% for sure. It's just a question of when. And by the laws of probability, it'll be in the next one, two, or no further off than the third generation, our grandchildren's generation.
Wow.
No later than that.
On that scary note, we have to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come back and, wow, I didn't know we missed something like that by 3 days.
Yeah, if something like that, when something like that happens, what can we expect? What types of damage would that do in today's society? Let's hit that when we come back.
Squashed by a giant. You're listening to We the People. Our guest is Dr. Peter Pry. We'll be right back.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Say, you learned your lesson
all the way. Forgot about that, the old Western Union song. Well, our guest today is Dr. Peter Pry. He served as the Chief of Staff to the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission. And so we're talking about EMPs today, all factual. And I just happened to look at my news update while we were on break there. Power outage at the Atlanta airport causes pandemonium in grounds flights. That was this morning a few hours ago.
There you go.
Little power outage, and it messes grounded up the entire city of Atlanta. So,
Peter, what types of things can people expect to see if a natural EMP were to occur? And my other question was, if these natural ones, we can predict them, we know they're going to hit us. If we turn everything off, I know the grid is going to get fried. But as far as your own personal electronic devices, if you turn everything off, this thing passes, can you turn them back on and, say, run off a generator, or are they done?
Well, for the natural EMP, you don't have to worry about turning off small electronic devices. You don't have to worry about your automobile or airplanes flying through the sky, because the natural EMP doesn't do damage as deeply. It's different from the nuclear EMP, which is far more damaging. That's because the wavelength for a natural EMP is very large. It's on the order of a kilometer. So anything that has a dimension that's less than that basically doesn't get affected by it. It needs great big targets like the electric grid, communications, telephone lines, railroad tracks. It'll couple into railroad tracks, pipelines, things like that. but an automobile is too small. Your personal computer is too small. And your personal computer will be survived even without your turning it off. The problem is that the natural EMP will destroy the electric grid. And, because the electric grid is not protected against it. It'll melt big extra high voltage transformers. For example, in Canada, the 1989 Hydro-Quebec storm, which was not a superstorm, okay? It was a more powerful run-of-the-mill kind of storm. But it melted BHV transformers, that's extra high voltage transformers that are designed to carry 750,000 volts. It melted them in 90 seconds, okay? And you can't come back from that. If we lost large numbers of BHV transformers, fortunately it didn't destroy large numbers in 1989. But it did destroy an EHV transformer and a nuclear reactor in New Jersey. And, you know, the coils were actually melted. Yeah. So you can just imagine the power, and that's from a run-of-the-mill type storm. These EHV transformers there are two things that are to our civilization what aqueducts and roads were to the Roman civilization, the classical world. You know, you couldn't support the Roman Empire and Roman civilization without aqueducts and roads. And our modern electronic civilization can't survive without EHV transformers and SCADAs, because they are what makes everything work, particularly in the electric grid. These EHV transformers are bigger than a house. They weigh hundreds of tons. There's only 2,000 of them in the United States, all right? But if we lost a substantial fraction of them, you know, we would not be able to replace them. They're not even made in America anymore. This is one of the ironies. We invented the electric grid here in the United States. Nikola Tesla invented it at the turn of the century, and we exported the technology for electric grids to the whole world, and in effect brought the world into the electronic age. But like so many things, we don't make that technology in America anymore. We have to import our own EHV transformers now from South Korea and Germany, and they have to be custom-made. You can't mass-produce them. The windings are done by hand, because every EHV transformer plays a slightly different role in the grid, and you can't place them on a mass-produced basis. Each one has to be custom-made, and it takes 18 months to build just one of them.
Wow.
In fact, the worldwide production of EHV transformers, the entire world can only make less than 200 EHV transformers a year. And so you can do the math yourself. You know, we've got 2,000 EHV transformers. If a geomagnetic superstorm destroyed 2,000 of them, well, it would take 10 years to replace all 2,000, even if the entire world was willing to dedicate its entire productivity of EHV transformers just to the United States.
So,
and, of course, 10 years, we don't have 10 years because we'll lose 90% of our population in one year.
Right. So when you say 2,000, that's 2,000 of these transformers that are actually online right now.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And just as important as them is something that's on the other end of the scale in terms of size, and they're called SCADAs, Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Systems. When I was a kid, when I was in the 1970s, 1960s, we had hundreds of thousands of blue-collar technical workers running the electric grid, running with the waterworks, running gas pipelines, you know, running all of the basic utilities that we take for granted. There would be guys who would sit there and watch the flow of water, the flow of electricity through a gauge, regulate it, all right? And they would know how to, being technically trained. If something went wrong, they would be able to go out and fix it, do the workarounds. And all of these people were replaced in the 1970s during the microelectronics revolution by what we call SCADA, Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Systems. They're little computers about the size of your personal computer, and they're everywhere. There's millions of them, and they run everything now. So you can run a whole city with a dozen people or fewer than a dozen people from a control center. But as long as the SCADAs work. But if the SCADAs are destroyed or something goes wrong with them in large numbers, then we're in trouble. I mean, the SCADAs were designed by geniuses basically to be used by idiots, you know? and if we lose the SCADAs, that's just as bad as losing those EHV transformers. You know, the people, there are not enough people working in the utilities to replace them. And there are so many of them, they're so numerous, that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to replace them in large numbers if they were destroyed by a nuclear EMP. It would require a nuclear EMP, though, to destroy the SCADAs. They would, but they would go out when the grid goes black. And, so those are some of the hazards. Perhaps I should just talk you through, we started with the natural EMP, but maybe I can give you a little timeline of what to expect. I mean, immediately, there would be no running water because it requires, hundreds of millions of volts to purify and pump running water to our major metropolitan areas. In 3 days, most places now only have emergency power, only enough fuel on site to support 3 days of emergency power at hospitals, police stations, airports. So in 3 days, the emergency generating power would fail in most of the major public, utilities or emergency systems. And this would include big regional food warehouses that we need. We only have enough food in grocery stores to feed the local population for about 3 days normal consumption rates, and then it has to be resupplied from these big regional food warehouses, and their emergency generators only last 3 days too. And so the food would then begin to spoil in 3 days. And even if it didn't, we only have 30 days enough food in the country to feed the population of 320 million people for 30 days. But the food won't last 30 days. It will begin to spoil in 3. Then in 7 days, we've got 100 nuclear reactors in this country. And if the grid is out for 7 days, those 100 nuclear reactors, their emergency batteries will fail. That's their last resource for cooling the cooling ponds where the nuclear fuel rods are, for cooling the reactor cores. So in 7 days, with no emergency power to circulate water anymore, they would go Fukushima, and you would have radioactivity spread, throughout the country. And basically, it then becomes a clock ticking toward, the starvation of 320 million people plus society falling into chaos. Because we also know that 24 hours after the lights go out from things like hurricanes and tornadoes, the worst elements of society emerge. And, law enforcement tends to fail, especially when they don't have communications. You won't be able to get, even though your car would run after a geomagnetic superstorm, it won't run without gasoline. And, there won't be any gas in gas stations. There won't be natural gas coming in anymore to run power plants or to heat your home. So that's the situation with a natural EMP.
Now, before we go to the nuclear one.
Wait, hold on. Guys, we've got a million questions, but we have to take a really quick break, or we're going to be totally screwed up here.
Okay, cliffhanger time.
Really quick break, and then we'll come back. Have to absorb this momentarily. We are chatting with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and if you're not worried already, you will be soon. Sorry to be so stressful the week before Christmas, but this is really important, and I think a lot more people need to understand how this works. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People.
I'll be right back.
Sunshine came softly through my window today. Could have tripped out DC, but I've changed my ways. Take time, I know it, but in a while, you're gonna be mine, I know it, we'll do it in style, cause I've made my mind up, you're going to be mine, I'll tell you right now, any trick in a book and a paper.
Just like Adam and Eve.
shape to the sky. I've never been so high.
So
if they do drop the bomb on us, it will be like Adam and Eve.
So I have one question, Peter, before we moved on to the nuclear part of this thing. In the event of a coronal mass ejection, how much time would we have before it actually hit the Earth?
Yes, thank you for raising that question. It occurred to me that I had forgotten to answer it, and I was going to go back to answer that. It depends on the nature of the coronal mass ejection. It takes a normal coronal mass ejection, the kind that hits us every year that causes these things like a Hydro-Quebec storm. It takes about 3 days. 3 days for the CME to cross the 97 million miles from the sun to the Earth. But the Carrington event in 1859 was much faster than that because it was much more energetic. So it only took 11 hours.
Wow.
But that doesn't mean we've got 11 hours or 3 days of early warning, which is one of the things that NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, and those who try to give false reassurance that they're on top of this, they can deal with this. You know, one of NERC's arguments has been that, well, we'll see the coronal mass coming and we'll be able to turn off the grid to protect it, which is not a guarantee it would survive. When you turn electronics off, it does increase the chances that they'll survive, but it's no guarantee. You know, the only guarantee of protecting electronics is hardening them, you know, so that you know they're protected. Now, the reason we don't have 3 days or 11 hours is because it matters what the charge is on the coronal mass ejection. It can have a positive or a negative charge. If it's got a positive charge, we're going to be okay because it won't couple well with the magnetosphere, and then basically there won't be a storm. However, it's got a negative charge, it will couple with the magnetosphere. And we can't tell what the charge is on the coronal mass ejection until it's about 15 minutes out from Earth.
That's
because
great.
We used to have a satellite called the ACE satellite. It's out in deep space. It's about 25,000 miles out. And that's about 15 minutes in terms of the speed that the CME travels. And that will tell us what the charge is, whether it's positive or negative. Now, the ACE got old, and they replaced it with another old satellite called the Discovery satellite, which unfortunately was never really specifically designed for this purpose. People call it the Al Gore satellite because it was actually built many years ago, about 20 years ago, for climate change research. And it's been sitting in a warehouse. And what they did is they added a sensor to it, so that in addition to climate change research, it will also have a sensor that can tell us what the charge is on the coronal mass ejection. And so they shot that out to replace the ACE satellite. I think that was a bad idea. I think it's always a bad idea. Even though it's been sitting in a warehouse, it's really old. And, you know, you want to know on such an important matter as this.
Yeah.
You want to know absolutely positively for sure if you're getting the right data, if it's right. That's why we couldn't rely on the ACE satellite anymore. It got so old, it started giving false readings. And I'm not sure the Discovery satellite, given how old it is going to be that much of an improvement. You know, we should put out a new satellite dedicated to this purpose. It's such an important thing. The other issue about, you know, this idea about turning off the grid, and I would be in favor of that, okay, if we did have a warning enough time, but you've only got 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I think politically, I find it impossible to imagine that NERC, that the North America would, and the rest of the countries of the world for that matter, suppose they saw a big coronal mass ejection coming, and they didn't know what the charge was on it yet, but we knew that because of its speed and its size, that it was going to be something like the Carrington event, and that it was probably going to hit us. Still, there's a 50-50 chance that it might not do anything, because we don't know what the charge is. Under those circumstances, would the whole world really shut down their electric grids? I mean, people are going to die when you do that. There's all kinds of negative consequences. You're going to have to leave the grid off for a couple of days, okay, so that the whole world would be without electricity for days. There are things that happen to nuclear reactors, the food. You know, there's a big price to be paid, and it would, and the price would probably include the loss of sacrificing, you know, thousands of lives, people that are on life support and on various kinds of situations. And it also seems to me that, you know, that given the behavior of the utilities in the past, they're not going to take that responsibility. They don't want to be sued. It would have to be a decision the world leaders, like the president, would have to make a decision about whether to shut down the grid. And when you tell Mr. President, well, it's possible that nothing might happen because we don't know what the charge is, isn't the president going to want to wait and know for sure what the charge is on that thing to find out? Well, if he does that, he's only got 15 minutes. You know,
this is like one of those really bad movies that you think is fake, but actually there's a version of this really scary movie that's real.
Yeah, and 15 minutes, is that even enough time to shut it down at that point?
It isn't enough time. It isn't enough time. Look at our. I like to use the analogy of our Minuteman ICBM launch crews, okay? They are highly disciplined. They exercise for launching Minuteman missiles in 20 minutes or less all the time. There's a command and control infrastructure set up, ballistic missile early warning radars, satellite radars, emergency communications. And our guys need 20 to 15 minutes early warning to be able to launch those missiles, okay? They can barely do it, but they wouldn't be able to do it if all they had was 15 minutes warning. So why should we expect the utilities to be able to do that? They don't have anything like the command and control. There's 3,000 different utilities. It's not like there's only one big utility, and there is no protocols, no command and control system, not even a legal protocol set up where the president could get on the pick up a red telephone and suddenly have all these guys. We've never even practiced a nationwide shutdown of the electric grid. I mean, it's just ridiculous to think we could even do that. Yeah. We're not even prepared to do it. And if we did do it, it wouldn't be any kind of a guarantee that it would solve the problem.
That's not an option.
That's the early warning we have. You know, we do have, in the case of a normal geomagnetic storm, we've got about 3 days. Of course, if it's a superstorm, it could be as little as 11 hours or less. And we don't, but that doesn't translate into how much early warning. We've really got only 15 minutes of early warning because I don't think anything is going to be done until the coronal mass ejection touches the A satellite so that we'll know what the charge is on the coronal mass ejection.
So I guess this begs the question, we've had an EMP commission, and when was that started?
2001.
Wow.
And it was preceded by 5 years of congressional hearings on EMP to do due diligence to find out, well, are we doing anything about EMP? Who knows about it? Is the intelligence community following into this? The Department of Defense? So there were 5 years of congressional hearings that I ran before we had the EMP commission that began in 2001, and the commission was on and off for 17 years until this year when it was closed in the end of September. And ironically, in the very month that North Korea tested a hydrogen bomb, which it described as being capable of a super powerful EMP attack, and then a couple days later, North Korea released a technical report called the EMP Might of Nuclear Weapons, accurately describing a super EMP weapon. And then Washington, in its wisdom, decided to close down the EMP commission.
And what was the thought process behind that? I guess I'm using the term thought process loosely.
Yes, right. Well, it's complicated. It's a case of killing the messenger, you know. I mean, it happens in Washington all the time. You know, when you don't like the message, you kill the messenger. And this isn't a phenomenon that's limited to Washington. I mean, it goes back to as old as history. I mean, Shakespeare's play, Henry II, will no one rid me of this troublesome priest? you know, we've been killing the messenger for quite a while. Who doesn't like the message? There's a lot of people. You have to remember, first of all, there aren't that many people that are experts on EMP. It's just a handful of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who are technical experts, people who are intelligence officers who have been following this, the military writings and the operational and the military plans of potential adversaries. So you've got a handful of scientists and intelligence officers and strategic thinkers who've known about EMP all through the Cold War. Not many of us, a handful of us, okay? We do have the facts on our side, and that's always helpful, but it's not always enough to win the fight, the political fight. Because there are powerful interests against us, all right? For one thing, I've mentioned NERC. You know, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation doesn't want to do anything about EMP. Doesn't want to do anything about cyber warfare either, or physical sabotage against the grid.
But why is that? Yeah.
It costs them money. And it could entail additional government regulation. You know, somebody looking over their shoulder. Right now, the electric power industry is the last critical infrastructure that regulates itself. You know, there is no organization like the Federal Aviation Administration or the Pure Food and Drug Administration that has real substantial regulatory authority that can force them to do things. There should be, but there isn't. You know, the closest thing we've got is this thing called the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But the FERC is just a bunch of lawyers who used to work for the electric power industry. This political scientists would call the phenomenon regulatory capture, where the agency that's supposed to be overseeing the electric power industry basically is in the pocket of the electric power industry. And they're just one actor, okay? But they don't want to do anything. I know that that's hard for people to believe, let me provide clarification right here and now. I'm not a big fan of big government or government regulation. I'm a Tea Party conservative, all right? A Jeffersonian type conservative who believes in small government and that government which governs best governs least. But even Thomas Jefferson, who was the, you know, ultimate libertarian, was not an anarchist. You know, Jefferson said, well, we do need government. We need government to provide for public safety and for the common defense, and that's what government is supposed to do. And the reason we need government to do that is because the private sector won't do it. You know, you can't rely on the private sector to take on the jobs of national security and homeland security and public safety. You've got to have government looking over their shoulders to do that. Now, I believe in the private, you know, free enterprise is the best, most ingenious system that's ever evolved for providing goods and services to people at the lowest cost. But their object is profit and doing things at the lowest cost. And as a consequence, if you don't have government to look over public safety, you will have things such as what happened in the 19th century. I mean, Coca-Cola, there was a time when Coca-Cola actually did have cocaine in it, all right?
Right.
And when, before there was a Pure Food and Drug Administration, thumbs would show up in people's cans of peaches and rancid meat would be sold to the public. Opium was in common drugs that could be bought by anybody. Addictions were very common. Look at the Zeppelin industry in the 1920s, all right? Here's a whole industry that convinced itself that it was safe to transport the flying public by hydrogen gas balloon, all right? Highly explosive gas. They could have bought helium for a little bit more, but they didn't want to do that. It would be more expensive. And they convinced themselves that through the genius of their operational procedures that they would never have a Hindenburg. But a Hindenburg did happen eventually, and it put the whole Zeppelin industry out of business. So, you know, the libertarian kind of argument is that, well, you can trust the private sector to, because it's in their long-term interest to stay in business. But no, that's not true. You know, we didn't have safety glass and seat belts and balloon, passenger balloons in automobiles until government required that. Bhopal, India, Union Carbide, when they were making pesticides in the United States, didn't want to spend the money on the government regulations to make them here in this country, to make pesticide manufacturing safe. So they went to Bhopal, India, you know, where they didn't have to obey those regulations. I understand the estimates that people are still dying from the pesticide accident that happened in Bhopal, hundreds of thousands of them. I think it's rivaling the casualties from the Hiroshima bomb, okay? Now, that's what happens when you just leave industry completely unfettered. And basically, NERC is in charge. This whole country is the Hindenburg. captained by the nerve, heading for a rendezvous with a geomagnetic superstorm or a North Korean EMP attack right now. And that is because even though these guys have children, okay, and they have grandchildren, they're also that's not their job. You know, their argument, NERC would say, if they were in this room right here, their argument would say, well, it's the job of the Department of Defense to protect the country from these things, not in the electric power industry. And you know what? They would be right. They would be right. It is the job of the Department of Defense and of the U.S. government. And that's why the government and the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense should be working together and telling NERC, you must protect the grid. And Congress should be passing laws that require them to pass the grid, and it should be they should be told how to do it. Maybe the government should even pay for it, and it should be inspected.
Well, this would be part of, national defense. I mean,
this is what the commission recommended, okay?
Yeah.
But we have other enemies aside from the NERC, all right? One of them being the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense doesn't want to be responsible for protecting the electric grid or helping protect the electric grid. They're really fearful of their monies being siphoned off to help protect the electric power grid. The Department of Defense kind of has forgotten that line in the Constitution about providing for the common defense. That's their purpose.
Right.
They think they provide for the common defense by being prepared to fight wars overseas. I mean, yeah, just like NERC does one thing really well, one of those things being protecting itself from government regulation, the Department of Defense over the years is not a philosopher that thinks deeply about, well, you know, protecting the American people and their homes actually should be job one. That's not how they think over there. They think job one is going over to Afghanistan to kill the Taliban. All right, that's job one for them.
Well, all of this seems very far. I'm sure, you know, well, it's not happening today. It's not happening right now. So we'll get to that later. Oh, my gosh.
That's true. Also,
we have to take one more quick break before the top of the hour here. Sorry, I hate to cut you off because we could just listen to you talk for another hour. Hey, that's coming. We are here with Peter Vincent Pry. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, actually, and we'll be chatting about EMPs. You're listening to We the People Radio. Find us on wethepeopleradio.us.
No place to hang out or washing, and then I can't blame all on the sun. Oh, no, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Oh, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take.
You got me shaking, got me running away. You got me crawling up to you every day. Don't bring me down. No, 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 no. I tell you what, though, before I get off the floor, don't bring me down, down, down.
It's too late.
Bring me down, man.
It's too late. Okay. So Bill's got a million questions for you, Dr. Pry, but we're making him wait till after the top of the hour. Because I want to because I want to finish this part about the political side of it.
I get no respect.
Exactly.
We got to do that part, because how do we get back to a place where this becomes national security again?
Because that is the very problem. You've touched it with a needle, you see. There are so many people who think that solving the EMP problem is technical or it's a question of money. No, it isn't. We know how to protect against EMP, and it wouldn't even cost that much.
Oh.
The problem is political. It's the politics of EMP that's going to get us killed at the end of the day if we can't resolve the political problem. And it's the political problem that has stalled progress on this issue for 17 years. And so we talked about the problem from industry, from NERC. We talked about the Department of Defense, for example, its internal bureaucratic interests. A huge obstacle has been the holdovers from the Obama administration. You know, because for half the country that supported the Obama administration foreign policy, EMP is a politically incorrect threat, especially nuclear EMP attack.
Why?
Okay?
How does that happen?
Because of the Iran nuclear deal, and because of the situation in North Korea, and because of President Obama's foreign policy goal of a world without nuclear weapons. Let's start with this world without nuclear weapons claim. The left, to try to sell the idea that achieving a world without nuclear weapons was a good and realistic thing, tried very hard to make the case that nuclear weapons basically don't have any utility, that a primitive country like a North Korea and Iran, they could never compete with us, they couldn't really pose a serious threat with us, even if they started to get the bomb. And so if you accept that premise, then it starts to make a world without nuclear weapons sound like some kind of a negotiable, more achievable kind of a thing. But EMP is a huge contradiction to that worldview, because you don't need a sophisticated nuclear weapon. You only need one nuclear weapon to destroy a whole country, including the United States. And so even if you take, for example, the Iran nuclear deal, even if Iran was somehow clandestinely to build just one bomb, it would make the Iran nuclear deal worthless and a failure. And the verification requirements to ensure that Iran couldn't build even just one bomb would have to be much more stringent than what they had in the Iran nuclear deal, which has some of the worst verification provisions that have ever been conceived in any nuclear deal. So EMP threatened the idea of a world without nuclear weapons. It threatened the Iran nuclear deal. And Obama's claim, his dismissal of the North Korean nuclear threat all through his administration, is also belied by the EMP threat. Because, again, you don't even need a reentry vehicle. You know, you can detonate the weapon in outer space. North Korea was, people even now act like North Korea. They need a reentry vehicle to pose a threat to the mainland of the United States. Not true. The EMP Commission has been warning for years, including during the Obama administration, that they could already threaten the United States with an EMP attack. You only need one weapon. It doesn't need to be accurate. It doesn't need to be able to reenter the atmosphere. You don't even need an ICBM. You could deliver it off by a short-range ballistic missile launched off a freighter, some kinds of cruise missiles that can be used, a airplane doing a zoom climb. Even a meteorological balloon can get up above 30 kilometers to do a nuclear EMP attack. All of these things were possible for North Korea during the Obama years.
Hold that thought. That was the news that was trying to interrupt us. Darn news. We've got 5 minutes of news, so grab some coffee or whatever you like, and we'll be right back with Dr. Peter Vincent Pryor. You're listening to We the People.
On KCNR, Shasta Redding.